Serial number R16, August 6, 1963. 9:20 a.m. address is by Dr. Robert Bellhammer.
Mr. Mayfield and ladies and gentlemen, I am a little bit on the spot this morning. The subject, as you know, is world confessional bodies and Christian unity. And I have been asked by a world confessional body, namely the World Methodist Conference, as a staff member of the World Council of Churches, to come here and talk to you about this. Now, I suppose you assume, as I know, that the situation is not all sweetness and light, or else there would be no reason to make a speech about it. And it is for that reason that I feel a little bit on the spot. It is not all sweetness and light. The debate is a real debate, but it is only just begun. And therefore, again, I am on the spot because I am not sure, and I think there is hardly anyone that is certain, as to what the terms of the debate really are. So I must think aloud with you this morning. And I hope that you will take what I say as thinking aloud. Of one thing I am certain, that I do not want you to construe what I say as an attack in any sense upon the World Methodist Conference, an attack offered in general terms. If I or my colleagues in the World Council of Churches had anything against the World Methodist Conference, I would say so flat out. I am dealing with a problem. And to be sure, the World Methodist Conference, in the nature of the case, will participate in that problem, as we all will. But I wish to say what I have to say in that spirit, and invite you and the World Methodist Conference to continue work on the basic problem with which we are all faced. World confessional bodies, exactly what are we talking about? We are talking about a number of organizations, about the Friends World Meeting for Conference, I believe its title is, the Quaker organization. About the International Congregational Union, the Congregationalists World Organization. About the Baptist World Alliance. About the World Methodist Conference, about the Presbyterian World Alliance, about the Executive Officer of the Anglican Communion, who writes to us and insists, "I am not a confessional body." About the Lutheran World Federation, and I hope I've not forgotten any. All of these are world confessional bodies, and they are agencies of varying degrees of strength. The Friends organization has scarcely any program at all and meets only occasionally for conference, and as I gather from the Friends, even the most tentative kind of conference. The International Congregational Union, similarly, is a most skeletal organization, and the moderator of it at present is a staff member of the World Council of Churches, Dr. Goodall. The Baptist World Alliance is stronger, and so on they go up to that which is manifestly, organizationally, the strongest of all, the Lutheran World Federation. But it is perfectly clear that the drive in practically all of them is toward increased strength since 1948, since the founding of the World Council of Churches. So that world confessionalism is finding an expression to a greater or a less degree, but in general to a greater degree, in the strengthening gradually of the world confessional organizations. To raise, therefore, this question, as it has been raised this morning, world confessional eight bodies and Christian unity, is, as soon as you look at it for a moment, to raise the question of world confessionalism and Christian unity, and that question, it opens the whole question of the problem of the church, of the churches, and of Christian unity, a problem with which we have been wrestling these days, and we will all continue to wrestle. This is not, in other words, a merely organizational or institutional problem. It is a profound problem concerning the life of the church today and must be looked at in all of its dimensions as such. There is one thing, however, which would seem to me to be perfectly clear, and that is that what is now become a kind of a traditionalist argument in justification of world confessional agencies is too simple and is misleading and is dangerous. I would suggest and want rather stoutly to maintain that if the argument which lies behind the development of world confessional bodies is the following argument, it will do a disservice to the cause of Christian unity. Namely, that the function of world confessional bodies is to consolidate the denominations and the confessions in order to make a contribution to Christian unity and to the ecumenical movement. That argument, consolidation in order to contribute, seems to me too simple and misleading and dangerous to the cause of Christian unity. The matter is far deeper and far more complex than that. The ecumenical movement, which is not to be confused with the World Council of Churches, the World Council being simply an expression and a partial expression of the ecumenical movement, is, after all, composed of denominations. The World Council term for denominations is member churches. But whether they are called member churches or denominations, the reality is the same. And these member churches, these denominations, make up the ecumenical movement. We can discuss and have our different convictions as to how much of a plus there is in the ecumenical movement over and above the sum total of the denominations. But the plus is always a plus onto something, and the basic structure, the basic reality, is the reality of churches and of denominations. Now, my first point in dealing with the problem of world confessionalism and Christian unity, my first real point is that these denominations, these member churches, are all under pressure. By pressure in this context, I mean, first of all, that these denominations are under pressure not only to contribute to the whole, but to learn from the whole. Not only to stand up and make their witness to other churches, but to sit down and listen to the witness which other churches have to make to them. They are under this pressure, all denominations all over the world. But when you say that a denomination is under pressure not only to witness to, but to listen to, you are then saying that the justification for this denomination as such is somewhat under question. You are then saying that the denomination which is going to listen to other denominations is not self-sufficient. It can't be assumed that this denomination, which is under pressure to listen to others, has all the truth. That really means that the denomination itself is under the pressure of a question. And the question is, at its depth, I would think, what is the real justification for this denomination at this time in this form? Now, all denominations are under pressure in this sense in the current ecumenical situation. And I would suggest that they are under this pressure in four different ways. First, they are under this sort of pressure simply because of the world we live in. I need not, I trust, spend very much time on this point. It is too obvious and the pressure is too powerful. The world becomes one. As the world becomes one, the ecumenical movement, that is, oneness in the church, grows up. And however you analyze the origins and the growth of the ecumenical movement, that is, the growth of the sense of togetherness among the denominations, you must always come out with at least one element in your analysis, and that is that the very events of contemporary history, the developments in the world, have forced these churches together. Now, some people don't like that argument because they think that that means that the ecumenical movement has grown up simply defensively in order somehow to protect the churches against a growing unity in the world. But I would suggest that a far deeper and broader view of this pressure from the world upon the churches would have to come to terms with the question, is not God at work in the production of the unity in the world itself? Is it not to be thought that God is forcing the churches by himself creating unity in the world so that the churches must come to terms with it? Is the hand of God not to be seen in all of the tremendous developments which are producing a unity in the world and as a result putting pressure upon the churches, upon the denominations, themselves to achieve unity? The first point of pressure is clearly from the world. Second, the denominations are under pressure from the desire and the will in the part of some churches to achieve unions. South India, now Ceylon, North India, East Africa, West Africa, Great Britain, the United States, to mention a few, are all places in which there are active and important discussions or negotiations centering around either a general proposal or a concrete plan of church union. This means that the churches that are involved in these plans of union are having pressure put upon them. And it means that the churches to which these churches are related, the Methodist Church in Ceylon related to the Methodist Church in Great Britain, the church related to the church in Ceylon is having pressure put on it because of the desire for union in Ceylon. And so it goes with all of the various connections of all of these churches involved in church union. This desire for church union is, as we know, a thing of greater and less intensity. It is a very great desire in the churches of Asia. I remember talking with Bishop Chandu Ray, Anglican of Pakistan, just after the, to him, disastrous decision of the convocations of York and Canterbury concerning the plan of union for North India. And Bishop Chandu Ray, who passionately desires union for the sake of evangelism, simply looked at me with the most crestfallen face and said, "It means that we have to start all over again." And in his semi-despair, his near despair, I could see, as it were, the underside of his immense desire that this union be consummated. In other parts where there are negotiations and plans, the desire is less strong, largely, I suspect, because union is more of a luxury in these parts of the world than it is where they face such an immense evangelistic challenge. Nevertheless, the churches are under pressure from the plans for church union. And with these churches, of course, come at the same time, it is the same thing, the pressure upon denominations. Third, the denominations and the churches are under pressure from themselves as they meet in the ecumenical situation and in the ecumenical movement. What is, after all, a denomination? I don't answer the question historically at the moment. I'm more interested at the moment in a theological definition or understanding of a denomination. And theologically, it seems to me that the point can be put this way, that the denomination is the connecting link between the congregation and the church universal. Here we meet in our various congregations in the towns and in the cities all over the world. And we have a sense from the Bible and a sense from the Creed that there is the church universal. And how do we get connected in our congregations with this church universal? At the moment, we do it through denominations. We are a part, you are a part, of the Methodist Communion, as it is called, or the Methodist Church. And this has its tradition. And this goes back into history. And that goes back into history, and it is connected thus with the origins of the church, and therefore with the church universal. But it is through the company of the Methodists that your local worshiping congregation finds its sense of fellowship and its sense of participation in the universal church. Now, this is true of all denominations. This is the way local Presbyterians find their connection with the universal church, and so on with all denominations. As you meet in the ecumenical movement with denominations, each of which understands that the function of the denomination is to connect the local congregation with the universal church, you find each denomination saying, we are a valid, or some of them say, we are the valid connection. But then you react and you say, we are also a valid connection between the local and the universal. And as denomination listens to other denominations making this claim in these ways, pressure is put upon each denomination, the pressure being centered around the question, are you the only connection there is between the local and the universal? Is the Methodist understanding of this connection between local and universal the only understanding that is valid? I have heard it said here, and not by me, by a Methodist, that this is not to be said. Methodism is not the only connection in your own convictions. But it was not always so. And one reason that Methodists now see that the Methodist denomination is not the only connection between local and universal is because of the pressure upon the Methodist denomination by virtue of its ecumenical connections. And this is true right straight around all of the, let us say, 200 members, churches, member denominations of the World Council of Churches. I'm trying to say that the point of pressure upon denominations comes from denominations themselves in the ecumenical situation. And fourth, the corollary to the last point is that we are all in our denominations under pressure from our general awareness of the achieved universality of the church. The too oft quoted text of Temple, the great new fact of our time, did not refer to the World Council or to the ecumenical movement, except in the sense of the younger churches. He was talking of the fact in that enthronement sermon that younger churches have grown up, that the church is now, in fact, in a real sense, visibly universal. And we are all aware of this universality. I remember a discussion between Dr. Vissertoft and Dr. Latourette years ago. And Dr. Vissertoft was being somewhat critical of the Southern Baptists. And after he got through with his criticism, Dr. Latourette looked at him and said, yes, but through the Southern Baptists, the poor are having the gospel preached to them. And that is our awareness of universality. That is our understanding that whatever our doctrines of the church, there are companies of Christians all over this world universally preaching the gospel to the poor. And that awareness of universality puts pressure upon all of the exclusive tendencies within our own denominational conceptions. So from the world, from church unions, from the denominations themselves, and from the very fact of the universality of the church, pressure comes upon each and all of the denominations that make up the ecumenical movement. Now, and I come to the second major point, it is in this situation that world confessional bodies grow up and are strengthened and carry on their programs and operations. And neither I nor anyone that I know of has any question as to their right to do so. That's not the argument. The argument is, what are the world confessional agencies going to do in this ecumenical situation in which denominations the world over are under pressure? And broadly speaking, there are two courses of action. And broadly speaking, we see different confessional bodies following these two courses of action, sometimes right within their own policies. One is to react to the present situation among the denominations in the direction of confessional conservatism, so that the weight of a world confessional agency is thrown behind the business of conserving all that is in the confessions or in the denominations which make up the particular world confessional agency. A reaction of confessional conservatism. And the other possibility, as you will at once see, is to react to the present situation of pressure, the situation of fluidity, the situation in which the denominations themselves are in search of something in the same measure, so that a world confessional agency begins to help its member churches in their situation of fluid search for a greater unity. I have three specific points in mind. The first is the question of the world confessional body and the problem of truth. And here I think that the main point is a relatively simple point. But the bite to it comes very especially in the question of church unions. And very especially, I would suggest, at the point of church unions in Asia and in Africa. The bite comes at these points in Asia and in Africa simply because of the power of tradition and finance of the churches in the West. The power of the Methodist tradition is a power, and of all of our traditions, is a power largely located in the West, and largely conceived in Western terms, and the financial weight is nearly all in the West. And then in Asia and in Africa, churches will arise which want to unite with other churches, and that means in some real sense a break with the confessional tradition. Does not necessarily mean a total break, but it does mean a real break with a confessional tradition. Now, when that happens, what will be the attitude of the World Confessional Agency? I think the fundamental point at which to decide the attitude is at the point of truth. In other words, does the World Confessional Agency regard truth as something bigger than the confessional conception of it? Or does the World Confessional Agency, on the whole, think that its particular confessional tradition embodies as much of the truth as can be embodied and therefore should be put forward even at the cost of preventing or discouraging a union of churches? Now that is a deep going and an immediate and a controversial issue. And I would suggest that in the balance between confessional conservatism and contributing to the open, fluid, searching situations of the denominations, the World Confessional Agencies ought certainly to wrestle with the question of their own conception of truth and how they will define that conception of truth, and therefore how they will throw their weight, especially when the bite is on and unions are actually being proposed and sought. Second, is the question of world confessional agencies and action on the world level. I have in mind here particularly action that has to do with joint action for mission in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and with action that has to do with interchurch aid. And again, the question you can already discern. It is the same question, but it takes its form not only with respect to the basic issue of truth and attitude toward church unions. The same question takes form now in relationship to concrete programs of action involving men, strategy, money, and policy. And the question is, does a world confessional agency throw its weight behind a common action for mission in Asia, or merely a confessional conception of mission in Asia? Or if you don't like to be separated, either common or confessional, then in what measure of combination of the confessional and the joint action for mission will a world confessional agency really espouse? And the same holds true for interchurch aid. There are world confessional agencies which, either for a period of time or very recently, desire to do interchurch aid under a confessional banner. And there are, we are grateful, the vast majority of them, including the Methodist Church, which does its interchurch aid in an ecumenical framework. Now, it is perfectly legitimate that a confession carry on interchurch aid within its own circle and within its own confession. Nobody questions that. But the point is, where is the weight of the confessional world body thrown? Behind mission, behind interchurch aid, principally under a confessional banner, or behind interchurch aid and behind mission, which is conceived as a part of the great ecumenical search, that is, the great search of the churches together for joint action in mission and joint action in interchurch aid. And third, I have in mind what is perhaps the most important of all. What is in the mind of a world confessional agency the status and the meaning of a denomination as such? In the ecumenical movement, there has been a dramatic rediscovery of the Bible. We saw it again at Montreal. And there's a reason why this happens in the ecumenical movement. And the reason is simply that when you meet together as representatives of widely differing traditions, there is only one thing you have in common. There is only one place to go, and that is to the Bible. This rediscovery of the Bible is beginning in some slight measure, we make no boast about it, to shape ecumenical thinking. And to shape ecumenical thinking, especially about the nature of the church. Now, one might think that as you gather around as representatives of different churches and look at the Bible, that the debate would be as to whether the Bible, as it were, backs up one tradition more than it backs up another tradition. But that's not what happens. The Bible is a surprising book, and it has done surprising things to us. For it has made us in the ecumenical movement, that is, it has made the representatives of different denominations realize that denominations as such have to be called into question if you take the Bible seriously. For the Bible does not talk about denominations. The Bible talks about local congregations and the church universal. And in the New Testament concept of the church, this is all you find. To the church at Corinth and the body of Christ. And if you take the figure of the body of Christ, of which we are all members one of another, and try to stretch that to mean denominations, it is definitely a point of our own interpretation, for members one of another means persons. This biblical understanding of the church as local and as universal has eaten its way deeply into the thinking of the churches together in the ecumenical movement. At New Delhi, the delegates there adopted, or rather accepted and commended to the churches, a statement as to the nature of the unity that we are after. And it's all written out there in a brief paragraph. And it's interesting to read that. Because that statement of the New Delhi delegates about the unity that we are after follows the basic biblical line. It speaks of the unity of all in each place so united with the church universal. And implicitly, the New Delhi statement does what Montreal very explicitly did, namely in section 5 in Montreal, to say that the whole status of denominations in the church universal is by no means clear and must be thoroughly restudied. Now my point is simply, what is the attitude of a world confessional body toward the denomination as such? Does the world confessional body take it for granted that the denomination as such has a right to exist in its present form? Or does the world confessional body take it for granted, take it as given in the Bible, that the whole structure of modern church life, including the denomination, must be re-examined? If the world confessional body takes the denomination as such for granted and moves from there, it will exert one kind of influence upon the quest for Christian unity. If the world confessional body refuses to take the denomination as given, refuses to take it as for granted, but rather insists that the whole structure of modern church life, including the denomination, must be re-examined, then it will have a different impact upon Christian unity. So that the third point, in addition to its attitude towards truth, in addition to its attitude towards action, has to do, so far as I can see, with the attitude of the world confessional agency toward the denomination as such. And with all this, I conclude. As it seems to me, a key question right now for all world confessional agencies is the question, in what sense do you really represent your member churches? All these world confessional agencies have their member churches, which are all of the same confession. But in what sense do you really represent them? Do you represent them in their static, in their confessionally bound situation? Or does the world confessional body represent its member churches in their situation of pressure, in their situation of fluidity, in their situation of search after unity? Does it represent the denomination is as such, but also the denomination now caught up in the whole ecumenical situation? And my own conviction is that if the world confessional agency represents only the denomination as confessionally bound, the denomination in its static sense, if the world confessional body represents the denomination only in a conservative sense, it will do disservice to the cause of Christian unity. But if on the other side, the World Confessional Agency really represents the dynamism that is in the denominations which make up the World Confessional Agency, representing that dynamism, helping that dynamism, contributing to the search in which its own member churches are involved for a greater and a fuller Christian unity, then the World Confessional Agencies can have a very powerful part to play in that search and in the realization of the unity which we all seek. I thank you very much.